Today on Equity Merchants, our guest is Eunice Ajim, the founding partner of Ajim Capital. Before starting Ajim Capital, Eunice was the founder of DataGig, a platform that connected data science professionals with SMEs. She also co-founded Open Teams, a marketplace for open source talents. In today's interview, she shares her thoughts on Africans investing in startups, choosing a co-founder and the right time to raise from VCs. But first, a message from our sponsor, the TechPoint Africa business team.
Hi, I'm Abisola Adenoga, the head of business at TechPoint Africa. Are you an early stage startup looking for brand awareness for your organization or in search of potential investors and product engagements? Leverage TechPoint Africa's extensive network of startup tech enthusiasts, investors and executives on the African continent and beyond to elevate your brand and business. For inquiries, send us an email to business@techpoint.africa or click on the link in the description. Together, let's take your business to the next level.
Hello, Eunice. Welcome to the podcast. So first of all, can you introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, definitely. My name is Eunice Ajim and I'm the founding partner at Ajim Capital. We are a $10 million fund, US-based but African-focused VC firm that invests in early-stage startups across Sub-Saharan Africa. We are sector agnostic, but really look for B2B and B2B2C, asset-light, post-MVP, post-traction startups across the continent. Super excited to be here today, and thank you so much, TechPoint, for having me.
All right. Thank you for joining us. You mentioned that you're a founder at Ajim Capital, but before now, you were a founder at Open Teams and DataGig. So why did you make the change from being a founder, a startup founder, to becoming a VC? What inspired the move?
Yeah, definitely. I guess I could give a little bit of a background. And you know, like from my background and experience, it could probably lead to like how I became a VC.
Yeah.
So I'm originally from Cameroon and I came to the US about 10 years ago as an international student. And I think I've always been an entrepreneur at heart. I remember my dad sending me to the US and saying, hey, you know, like I did my best, right? As an African dad, send me to the US to further your education. Now you have to figure out how to pay for tuition and, you know, pay for your bills and the rest. So while in college, wow. I started a small business. Why going to school full-time? It was a very brick and mortar hairstyling business. And that really helped pay for my tuition. It helped pay for my bills. I think I was a rich college kid, not because I had rich parents, but because I could work for myself. But when you're an international student in the US, you have to, you know, when you graduate college, you have to get a regular job.
Yeah.
So right after college, I got my first job at Apple. And then like 1 year into it, I was like, man, I really hate working in corporate America. Like it's not innovative. I wanted to do things that was exciting. And, you know, like just being a regular employee didn't do it for me. So that eventually led to like me just trying to figure out, you know, what are some exciting things that are happening in the world that I can get involved with. And this time I wanted to be in tech because then the Ubers and the Airbnbs and like all these marketplaces were booming. This was like in early 2017. And also the same way that Web3 and the metaverse is booming right now is the same way that AI and data science was booming back then. So I said, how about I figure out a way? And my background was in data analytics. So I was like, how do I figure out a way to combine marketplaces and data science, which is obviously an industry that is fragmented right now and nobody really understands how it works. So that's how DataGig came about. I was like, I'm going to build a marketplace and I'm going to make it easy for data science professionals to get hired by SMEs.
Okay.
Quit my job, started working on it, struggled on it for a while, like any first time startup founder. There's so many challenges that comes along the way that you don't necessarily understand, from hiring, finding your first customer, building your MVP, you know, like really growing and scaling your products can be very challenging. And I struggled for about a year. And then when I was ready to go and fundraise, I got to the point where I was making about 30K MRR, right? Like if you're one of my founders or you've spoken to my team, we're very big on MRR, MOM, you know, like product market fit, like what, you know, like how's your product doing? How are you interacting with your customers? And it's because I've learned all of those as a startup founder. We started fundraising, met an investor that was just bullish about what we were doing. And he decided that we should come into a partnership. That partnership eventually meant closing DataGeek and then joining him and building Open Teams. And Open Teams was very similar to DataGeek in the sense that they were both marketplaces just for different industry. Now Open Teams were a marketplace connecting open source service providers with open source users. And Open Teams, obviously, you know, with the fact that I was not on my own anymore, I had other experienced people on my team. I wouldn't say blow up, but we were doing so much better as a startup than I was as a solo founder with my first tech company. And we raised, you know, about $3.7 million in two rounds of funding. And then took the company from zero to a few, you know, millions in, you know, 2 to 3 years. And when you're a startup founder and you start making a little bit of money, you want to give back. You want to figure out how you can help your community. Me personally, I've always tried to figure out a way how I can implement the African ecosystem into anything that I do. And that involved DataGeek. That also involved Open Teams. I remember in 2020, when the job market was crazy, I told my co-founders, let's hire in Africa, right? Like, let's give it a try. And my co-founders agreed. I eventually scrambled, like, looked through GitHubs, meetup groups, and I encouraged, like, anybody that I knew in Nigeria, in Kenya, and Rwanda. I was telling them, please tell your friends to apply to our job. We eventually hired a team of 5 to 7, I think, within a certain amount of time. But there were so many challenges when we were trying to hire those people, when we were trying to pay them, when we were managing our team. And I said, there must be a better way. I'm pretty sure there's a startup out there that is trying to fix this problem from the payment solutions, right? Like, how does an employer in the US pay their employees in Africa? Is there a platform out there that I can just go and find specifically African talents, right? And when I started searching for those, I joined a few syndicate groups that were very focused on the African continent, and I started seeing deals that were solving the problems that I had. So obviously, the right thing to do is to invest. And as I started writing small checks into these companies, I realized that as an African in the diaspora, nobody knows what is happening. Like, I did not know what the ecosystem on the continent was like until I started getting involved, right? As an angel investor and as a mentor and as an advisor. And I said, how come the rest of the world don't know that Africa is booming and the tech ecosystem is growing? But, you know, so I started exploring and digging more. And the more I got involved, the more I got excited about the continent. I said, you know what? I'm passionate about this, and I think there's an opportunity here, and somebody needs to bring light to the world. I don't want it to go on the continent, and I want to be one of those. So eventually decided to exit my company a little bit early and go full-time into launching Ajim. So I gave you the story, but I think it made sense to see the transition between me coming here and how I eventually, you know, transitioned to becoming a VC.
But I think the first time I either heard about you was probably 2018 or 2019. I can't remember when, but you were a mentor for Faith Code 54. So I think it's been interesting to watch your journey from being a founder, and then about 5 years later, you're now a VC. So I think I get the giving back aspect. Now, you raised $10 million for your fund, and that's a significant amount of money for any VC in Africa, not to talk of a woman. So how was that raising your first fund as a corporate VC, now no longer as an angel investor? So as a woman in particular, how was it raising your first fund?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it has been an interesting process. I'm going to say that. It definitely comes with a lot of ups and downs. Yeah. And to be quite frank, a lot of people don't understand this, but I'm still fundraising, right? I am fundraising and I'm deploying capital at the same time. Okay. And the way VC works, you have multiple closes. So even though you're raising a, you know, a $10 million fund, you can say, okay, my first close is going to be $1 million. And then I deploy that a little bit. I show traction to investors. And then I go again and I raise another $3 million. You know, I deploy that capital, show the awesome companies that I'm investing in. And then you just keep doing that and building it up to like, okay, now I have raised the full $10 million.
Okay.
It's very different from founders. Like founders, like you go out and you're like, I'm raising a $500,000 pre-seed round. You go out and you raise the whole money, right?
Okay.
For VCs, I'm raising a $100 million, you know, early stage VC fund. You go out, you raise $10 million, start deploying, you go out, you raise another, right? But like, you do that over a certain number of years. But it has been an exciting and interesting journey at the same time. I think people are starting to pay attention about emerging markets and about Africa specifically. Yeah. I think 2 years ago or 3 years ago, if I had gone out and said, you know, I want to raise a VC fund, it might be very difficult because there were really nothing to show around the African ecosystem. But now we are seeing a few unicorns, right? Flutterwave and Triple Cash and, you know, like all of these African companies becoming billion-dollar companies. We were seeing a few merger and acquisitions. You know, Paystack was a good example. A very few IPO, which is not necessarily the best ones, right? Jumia is an example that everybody knows, but like one that was very recent, which is technically like an African company, was Swivel, for example, right? So now we are seeing more and more more African companies raising pre-seed and seed and Series A, Series B, Series C. And that is a good indicator of a growing ecosystem. And my sales pitch to a lot of my LPs, which are my limited partners technically for giving me money, is you know, like Africa, like we're getting to the stage where like a lot of us, right, have mobile phones, a lot of us have computers, we have a vibrant and young population, right, that is super entrepreneurial minded. Nigeria being one of the biggest market, Kenya next, and quite a few other countries across sub-Saharan Africa. And the time to get involved is now, right? We might still be very early on in our process, but we're definitely getting at a better stage. So that has made my life a little bit easy when it comes to fundraising. But I mean, there's still different challenges that comes up that, you know, it's out of your control. And I've actually told myself that the investors that I have to like explain too much, you know, why Africa is such a good opportunity, might not be the right investor for me at this stage, right? Because the good ones are going to get it and they'll be willing to make the bet without too much selling.
When founders want to raise money, they are usually encouraged to raise from investors who believe in what they're doing and who are very open to letting them run the business as opposed to like telling them what to do. So the same way we have like product market fit, like an investor founder fit. So now you're not a startup founder in this case, but you're raising money from LP. So there's also a different argument about we needing more African capital deployed to African startups. So first of all, what's the composition of your LPs? So do you have a good number of Africans? And will you say that more Africans are willing to invest in startups as LPs?
Okay. I don't have a lot of African LPs yet, right?
Okay.
Right now I have about 26 of them, two of them Africans. And obviously you can tell that it's a very small number. But I think a lot needs to be done in terms of education to Africans, right? About the benefits of investing in a VC asset class. Literally, my team and I has been figuring out how to actually educate Africans in the diaspora on the continent about potentially investing in the private market, right? But there are several factors that we also need to take into consideration when capturing Africans. I'm all about, you know, Africans investing in, you know, in Africans. But there are a few factors that I want to like separate. The first one is cash flow, right? As Africans, there are definitely a lot of us who have a lot of money, right? Like we make pretty good money in the US or on the continent or wherever we are. But we try to invest in things that we're used to, which is what real estate, which is real assets, right? We invest in the public market because that's what everybody is doing, right? We invest in our 401ks and retirement plans, and we love luxury. Right, we spend a lot of money on like big vacation and expensive things. A lot of Africans, in my personal opinion, are not necessarily educated about how the VC asset class works. When you invest in the stock market, you can pull your capital anytime, right? We all see what the stock market, you know, the public stock market looks like right now. It's red, like it's bad. And what happens when the stock market is that when people are pulling away their money because they're scared of losing, you know, and like you can easily buy and sell and exchange that easily. When you invest in real estate, right, like the market goes up, you can sell your property, you get cash flow from rent and whatever. In the VC asset class, when you invest in the private market, we like to think of ourselves as patient and waiting investors. Versus, you know, buying and selling investors, right? Your money is locked in for at least 10 years. When I write a check to a founder, I can't push the founder to sell the company. I don't have a say in when the founders decide to sell.
Okay.
So, and throughout the years and years of being with a founder, they go through ups and downs. We all know the startup journey is not an easy ride. Right, which is the reason why so many startups fail. But the beauty about, and I was reading an article yesterday, the beauty about investing in the private market. This particular investor was talking about an example where he got into a Series A deal, right? And by the time they were getting to that Series A deal, shares were selling at 66 cents, right? They stuck around with that particular company, again, through ups and downs of them like investing and maybe doubling their money. By the time 8 years later, the company went IPO. And the company went IPO with shares at $24. So it went from 66 cents, right, to $24 by the time they went IPO. And for 6 months, as a private investor, you can take your money out. Right, so within the 6 months of them going IPO, their stock went from $24 a share to like $149 a share. Keeping in mind that they bought it on the private market for 66 cents. The average American and the average population got in at $24. VCs got in at 66 cents. Right. By the time they could touch their money, the value was at $149 per share. They stuck around and then they kept waiting. By the time they were checking out and they decided to sell the shares were like at $300 a share. Keeping in mind, they bought it at 66 cents. And the investor was even saying that if they had waited longer, the shares went all the way to $544. Right. But we are in it for the long game. You can be a VC and expect short-term return. And my experience with African founders, or not African founders, African LPs, when they come to me and they say, hey, Eunice, I'm interested in investing in your fund, they always ask me, what is the expected return? And like, you know, the average return in VC is anything between, you know, 3x to maybe 10x. And obviously there are other, you know, funds that outperform that number and can even go all the way to 100 or 200x return. And in simple terms, 3x to 10x is anything between 300% to 1,000% return on your investment, right? The average S&P 500 returns on average anything between 10 to 20%. 20% on the high end, which is very rare, and 10% on average on a yearly basis, right? The average real estate will probably return, again, very similar, 10 to 20%. And I'm saying this one is returning 300 to 1,000%, and this is like on the low end, right? But you have to be willing to play for the long game. It can be short term. You can't think, oh, I want my money back in 3 to 5 years. It has to be, I want my money back in the next decade, if not, you know, 2 decades. But that and a little bit of education in that sense needs to be done for Africans to understand that there's a different asset class that you should be thinking about. Again, there are other limitations. You have to be an accredited investor. And a lot of the people that I speak to are willing, right? They enjoy hearing about the returns and the long-term game, but maybe they don't fit the criteria of being an accredited investor, which can be a limiting factor for these investors. Okay.
All right. Okay. That's interesting. So let's look at your role as a VC. What role do you think VCs play in a startup's success?
Yeah, definitely. And again, very similar to my previous point, when we are investing in any company, right, our goal is for that company to succeed, right? Okay. So, you know, I might write, yeah, like we give you money and we are hoping that by giving you money, we get, you know, like some percentage of your company. But our goal is really to help you succeed. And that involves, you know, anything from helping you hire the best talents, helping you find your next customer, helping you, you know, with like your company culture. And different VCs play a different role. There are some VCs that are very hands-on, you know, like involved in the day-to-day activities of your company. And then there are VCs that are saying, hey, you know, I offer you my network, I offer you, you know, like any resources that I have, but I want to make sure that you succeed in your journey. And for me, particularly because I'm a solo GP, I can't get involved in the day-to-day activities of all the companies that I plan to invest in. So really what I try to offer to my founders is really access to my network. And that will involve, like, if you're looking help for hiring, I'll make sure that people in my network, you know, are aware and we can help you find your best hire. If you're looking, you know, if you're looking to fundraise, we'll help you everything from like drafting your pitch deck, you know, like figuring out what the right investors to target, making those initial introductions. If you need help with marketing and business development, we definitely have expertise in our firm to be able to help you out. But the founder needs to tell us, which is why I'm very pro founder sending out monthly updates. That way we know how your company is doing and we know how we can help you.
Okay. So you've been on two sides, one as a founder and now as a VC. So what would you say are like the biggest mistakes that startup founders raise when they are taking on investment?
Yeah, I mean, I think in my particular case, I'm a pre-seed and seed investor, right? And I think one of the biggest one I see right now on the African continent And I mean, I could say this is probably like anywhere in the world, is founders trying to raise money from VCs too early. Or, you know, just really focusing, because fundraising is like a full-time job. Like, it takes a lot out of you to be able to fundraise. But while you're fundraising, you still have to be managing your company. And I would say founders try to jump from, oh my gosh, I have a great idea. This idea is going to change how Africans, you know, live. It's going to make our life cheaper and faster and easier and all of these great things. And I'm like, great, that's great for you, right? But like, really focus on like, what is the problem? Who else in the world or who else around me have the same problem, right? Go find that person and say, if I was to build this, would you use it? Will it make your life easier? If the person is like, yes, it's a pain, you know, I'm really struggling with this. You know what? If you can build this and you can fix my problem, I'll pay you this much money at the end of every month just so that you can fix my problem. You know what I mean? I'll take a very easy example. I took an example of my particular case when I hired a bunch of African engineers and I had to drive at the end of the month to the bank just so that I could wire their money, right? And when I wire their money, it takes them 5 to 10 business days for them to get it. That's a very bad experience for me. It's a very bad experience for my employees. So somebody came up with a company that makes it easy for me to get on my laptop, right? Click a button and I pay all my employees and they receive it instantly. Obviously, I wouldn't mind paying an extra $50, right? Just so that my employees can get their money on time, but also so I don't have to waste 2 hours of my time in the day to go to the bank, right? To pay my employees. So they fixed a problem, they found me and I said, this is a pain, I hate doing it. I'm willing to pay you so you can fix it. Build a company, get the customers. But people think I have an idea, I'm gonna go raise money from VCs, I'll hire a bunch of employees, we're going to build an awesome product, and then we're gonna take it to our customers and they're going to love it. And then you end up realizing that nobody cares and nobody gives a damn, right? Like really focus early on in your career or in your journey as a startup founder to like, really think about what is the problem that I'm solving? Who are the best customers? How much like would they actually be willing to pay me for this particular problem? And if you can find a few people that are willing to even give you the money up front, right? So that you can solve that problem, you can use that money, bootstrap your company for a little bit, show a little bit more proof of concept, right? Yeah. If you can show a little bit of proof of concept, you can take that, go show to angel investors. They give you a little bit more money, maybe like $50,000, $100,000. Come back, fix the problem, improve it, show more traction, then come to VCs and raise money. I'm sure there are other VCs out there that will be willing to give you money with no traction and just an idea. I know I'm not one of them. So, and I know that because I've been a founder myself, right? If I can show you the work that I'm willing to put in, right, on my own and actually find the customers, then why should I give you my money? I've not raised money from VCs without showing traction. So why would I be the first to do it?
Okay, I get that. It's important that founders show skin in the game before having investors come on. Okay, so you mentioned earlier that raising money is like, for founders, it's a full-time job because it could take a very long time. And so as a result of that, a lot of VCs advocate that you should have like a co-founder or at least someone who handles all of this so that the business does not suffer while you're fundraising. So how would you advise a founder to choose a co-founder or to find a co-founder? So I have an idea, but it's just me. I didn't bounce the idea off like any other person, or I'm not building with anyone. So how would you advise a founder to like get a co-founder?
Yeah, I think like the idea of like founder and co-founder is something that I have mixed feelings about. right? There are some investors that say, I will only invest in founders, in companies that have co-founders. Yeah. I don't believe in that, right? I think I have I have two sides of that story. On one end, I think co-founders can break or can make your company, right? If you bring in the wrong person on in your executive team just because you feel like you need a co-founder and they are the wrong person for your company, they will bring your startup to the ground, right?
Right.
I personally think that two of the reasons why companies fail first is that, you know, they can't make any money, and making money could be anything from like making money from your customers or like bringing in money from VCs. The second one, you might have that, right? But like what eventually breaks is like executive team, right? Like if there are any arguments or misunderstanding or misalignments, right, between those co-founders, it can make or it can break your company. So I'm all about, like find a co-founder if it's somebody that like you trust, you think you guys work great together, right? And you think that they complement your skills and you guys are going to do amazing. But if you're just bringing a co-founder for the heck of bringing a co-founder, I'll actually ask you to be cautious about that. And I've actually had pretty successful founders reach out to me and say, hey, Eunice, VCs are telling me that they won't invest in me because I don't have a co-founder. And I'll just tell them that maybe that's not the right VC for you. Because guess what? Not every VC is the right VC for your business. Because I think you're doing pretty great. And I wouldn't just advise you to go find a co-founder for the heck of having a co-founder. You can hire executive teams, right? You can literally hire like a head of marketing versus like a CMO or like, you know, like a head of product or a head of, you know, technology, you know, like whatever, versus like a CTO, but you're still the executive. If you have your group of friends where you're like, hey, we really complement our skills. We've known each other for the last 10 years. You know, we work great together. We've done things together. You know, like we enjoy working with each other, right? And you have that and it's a beautiful thing. I'm happy for you. Great for you. You have a high chance of succeeding. But if you're a solo founder and you think that you can make things happen, without necessarily having, I think it's possible both ways. You just have to hire amazing people.
All right. So just a few light questions. How many startups do you have to reject in a day or in a month?
A lot. And it breaks my heart. Since the beginning of this year, I've seen a little bit of 1,000 decks. And that's like, you know, in 4 months. So I can say on average, you know, like we've had a little bit of a slowdown, but like from January to like, maybe like March, we were seeing an inbound of anything between, you know, like 300, like 200 on the low end to like 500 on the high end per month in terms of like applications and our venture scouts and like our VC network in terms of deck. And my fund, I plan on investing in anything between 40 to 50 companies over the next 2 years. So this year, I'll probably invest in like 20 to 25. Out of all of those, we have about 5 companies that we have allocations. So out of 1,000, we have 5 companies. So you can imagine the level of rejections we had to give, you know, to founders. And a lot of the time it's like, man, you have a great company. I wish I had more money to give you, right? And I wish I could actually invest, but like, I can't, like my hands are tight. So a lot of founders take it personally when like they hear no from VCs. They're like, oh, my company sucks. Or like, I'm not good enough. Like, no, like there are just more opportunities in the market than the money is available. And it's not about you. It's not because we think your company is bad. It's just because we have, and right now on the African market, it's crazy, right? In the US, you will not find that. But we have seen companies raising anything between, you know, 500,000 pre-seeds, maybe like $2 million seed. And these companies are making on average anything between $10,000 to $100,000 MRR, right? And they're raising pre-seed and seed rounds. This is high for like any startup. Like these are startups that are making money, like Series A here in the US, right? But on the continent, right, like because we don't have that much access to, there's like a little bit of a gap in terms of access to capital. Yeah. It's just unfortunate. And what I always advise to the founders that we reject is, yes, we might have said no, but no does not mean never. No does just means like not now, we think you're great, but we have this few companies that we're investing in. You know, we might actually like, we want you to keep updating us on your progress because we might want to come in Q2 or Q3 later on during the year. It's not just, it's just because we already have a set of companies that we're investing this year. And you can look at money, you know, now you can, there's so many ways to fundraise. You can crowdfund, get equity, you know, go and get equity, invite your friends and family to, you know, invest anything between $5, $10, $100. You can find money from angel investors. You can find money from accelerator programs. You can do debt financing. It's big on the African market. So there are different ways now that we are seeing startups implementing to be able to get a little bit of cash while that's still growing their company.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, so 2021 was like a great year for African startups. We had startups raising an approximately $5 billion. And the predictions at the beginning of the year was like, this would also be another record-breaking year. But I think startups are still on track to raise that, although there has been like a slowdown, at least in the announcements we've had in the last few weeks. So what are your predictions for the next 5 years for the African startup ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited about the African startup ecosystem. I think we're just getting started, put it simply, in the sense that, again, like I mentioned earlier, that like 2-3 years ago, right, there were really not that many unicorns, there were really not that many, there were really like not many, you know, M&As, and now we are seeing a huge network of potential unicorns, right, like getting into the market. And I think over the next 5 to 10 years, which is why I'm bullish. I'm one of those investors that I'm in it for the long term. Like I mentioned earlier, yeah. I'm not one of those investors that said that I'll promise you a return on your investment in 3 to 5 years. I'm like, we're in it for the decades, right? We're in it for 10 years. And I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see so much more M&As. We're going to see so much more unicorns. My hope is that we even see so many more companies go IPO on the, you know, on the US public market, obviously, because a lot of our founders are either getting acquired by, you know, like, you know, US or European or other companies, but also like, you know, like let's grow our own companies and also go IPO. My hope is that we see a lot more of those over the next 5 to 10 years. And we're just getting started, man. Like people keep praising how the African tech ecosystem raised, you know, about $5 billion in VC money last year. And I'm thinking, Africa is like a whole freaking continent with 54 countries. $5 billion is not that much money if you think about it.
Yeah.
I live in a very small city in Texas called Austin, Texas. And just this city, just Austin alone, raised over $5 billion in VC money last year. And we're talking about the whole freaking continent, right? So I want us to get to a stage where we're like, just Nigeria raised about $20 billion in VC money, right? And then the continent raised hundreds of billions in VC money. And, you know, like these many companies went IPO this year. And these many companies, you know, got exits, you know, and these many companies like raise subsequent rounds of funding. Like, that's where I see the African tech ecosystem. Where we saw, where with the US was maybe like, you know, like 10 years ago, I think Africa is picking up.
Okay. Okay, so exciting times ahead, and I think everyone should brace up. There's going to be more happening in the African ecosystem. Okay, so what sectors excite you? Like, Ajim Capital is sector agnostic, but like, what are the sectors that you just see and you're very excited about?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now I'm very focused around the infrastructure, like the digital infrastructure of the continent, which revolves a lot around, I mean, fintech has been a big one for the last couple of years, again, just because, you know, like, if you cannot transact online, then you can't do anything. But some of the other ones that I'm seeing that are really emerging is mobility and logistics, which is big. I recently did my first investment in a mobility company. Prop tech, you know, is also growing. It's something that it's like a sector that nobody really talks about, but if you're in real estate, you know, like, prop tech is really exciting. Education, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more creative ways, right, to reach the broader African youth, right, in terms of education. I think healthcare is a big one. I want to, you know, make sure that, you know, we make it as easy as possible, you know, for like every African, right, to afford and to be able to like have access to you know, to good healthcare. I don't think I have like a specific one. That I think marketplaces are also like a big one, like really bridging the gap between two, you know, two markets and bringing them on a platform. It has been very successful here in the US, and I think there's opportunity to break, you know, like the traditional business models that we've been used to on the African continent for so long. But yeah, lots of and things to be excited about on the continent.
Okay. All right, so I think that's all the questions I have. Thank you so much for your time. This has been an interesting conversation, and hopefully we get to do this sometime again when there's a whole lot more to discuss on Ajim Capital and Africa as a whole. So thank you so much,
Johnson. Yeah, definitely. Look at it. I think this has been an interesting but pleasant conversation. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining me today on the podcast. But before we go, a few things. Please share and like this episode. You can also catch up with previous episodes at Equity Merchants Show.